This is tape 5, side 1 of the oral history interview with Professor Joe Elder, October 11th, 2005.
To the extent I made any contribution I would think was significant for South Asian studies in Madison, it was being director of the center for about 12 years. Those were pretty bleak years. Washington was changing its philosophy about funding centers. For a while we were identified as arcane. For a while we were seen as leftovers of the Cold War. The boundaries had been drawn in terms of the U.S. interest in stopping the Soviet Union. And that was no longer an issue. And the Soviet Union sort of disappeared in 1988, 89, 90. We were seen as having divided the world according to the West and the Marxist world. We were spending much, much time learning languages. We were focusing on problems in India or in Pakistan, with keeping the magnifying glass on tiny stuff. We should be stepping back and comparing, let's say, the electoral process in Muslim countries and Hindu countries, or economic development in Buddhist countries and in Muslim countries or something like that. So the whole pitch was get away from areas. Stop focusing on the narrow thing. We want the principles of economics and sociology and politics, the generalizations. And there's some pretty nasty things being said in Washington about centers. Now, those of us in the centers felt it's fine to ask comparative studies and to say, let's look at what's happening to peasant rebellions in China and peasant rebellions in Bengal. That's kind of interesting. But if you are going to do something on peasant rebellions, you better know Chinese, you better know Bengali, and somebody somewhere has to do that. So we felt beleaguered, and the number of department centers lost their funding, in part because they were losing faculty, in part because I think there was a sense of cutting back, especially South Asia was no longer seen as quite so central, because the Soviet Union, the war in Afghanistan had ended, and South Asia wasn't as important in stopping communism or whatever. And the Islamic problem hadn't come up yet. But by keeping the Wisconsin profile strong, which we were able to do, I think we survived and almost came through the decade stronger than many of our competitors.
How were you able to do that?
We had the study abroad program, which nobody else had. And by now our alumni were beginning to appear in Duke and Berkeley and Seattle and other places like that. We had the annual conference on South Asia, which I think I mentioned earlier, which now became the place where the conference to which South Asians went every year. We had a summer program that taught languages, built in again to the study abroad program. We had the film distribution program, the only place that was consistently producing films and coming up with new film. So partly our structure just meant that we were busy in doing things during this period where various centers had their backs to the wall, and some of the centers were cut out. So at one point, Seattle lost its funding. At one point, Missouri lost its funding. At one point, even Pennsylvania lost its funding. That was scary. Pennsylvania had been one of the first places to get started. Then came the Islamic threat and 9/11, and what's bad for the world is good for South Asian studies and funding. Money has increased for the study of languages. We now, as a center, are the place in the United States to teach 9 of the South Asian languages. We are identified as the place, the only place that now teaches Indian language in the summer, so everybody comes here. Mm-hmm. We can pick the best faculty members to teach at all levels in whichever languages we have. That's been a dream of mine from the beginning, the business of why is it that you can't have a place where people who are any place in the U.S. who need to study Bengali or Marathi can come one summer and do first year, next summer, second year. But it took I think 9/11 and the need to say we've got to systematize this and get it put together in some place and get some additional funding for the office of education to make it possible for this to happen. So the instruction in South Asian languages is more coherent now than it's ever been, and it will presumably continue for at least the foreseeable future, and Wisconsin will be the center for that. So we sort of rode through the crest, and I think we're okay now.
And student enrollment is
each summer,
significant?
Each summer it's gone up. It is interesting, we thought that introducing languages that had not been taught before, we'd have a big influx of people who wanted to study Gujarati, let's say. There are lots and lots of second generation Gujaratis here, or Marathis. Ironically, the big class is Hindi. We have 30, 35 people coming here to learn Hindi, and Hindi is taught almost every other place as a center, but people don't take it in the summer, or they'll take first year during the year, and they want second year here. And ironically, the tuition that the students pay for Hindi helps us pay for, you know, second year Tamil or these little tiny classes that we have. It's a juggling act to figure out where the money comes from and then teach as many of these advanced courses as you can. I think we have a cutoff point of four. If there are four or less, we don't teach a language, but if there are five or more, we will.
Uh-huh.
But we've bent that several times. And then you can't tell. Four people say they're going to take it and two people show up. So you end up juggling unknowns against unknowns. But I feel that we're probably stronger now than we were. And then the AIIS is stronger now than it ever was. And if I could go a little bit to my involvement with the AIIS.
Absolutely.
Okay. I was elected...
And say for the record again...
The American Institute of Indian Studies.
Okay.
I had almost nothing to do with the American Institute of Indian Studies other than being funded that year I was in Lucknow.
Yes.
I was in that pioneering group that was told halfway through that we weren't going to get any more money.
Of taxes or
that's
something.
That's right. Indian taxes are going to take the rest. And then they worked it out. Since Wisconsin was a member center, it got to send trustees. I think we were allowed to send two trustees to the trustees meeting because it was a consortium. And this was not my game. I had my undergraduate program. I wasn't particularly involved with the center. So there were always other people from Madison going to be part of the trustees group.
And the year?
It began in 61.
Okay.
It worked for a long time with its base in the University of Pennsylvania, where Norman Brown, the great Sanskrit scholar, was the president,
mm-hmm.
which is absolutely natural. And then after Norman retired for a couple of years, Ainslie Embry from Columbia University and Duke was the president. And then it came to Chicago with Ed Dimmick, who was a Bengali literature person. And there were a lot of problems with it. The funding was gorgeous. The rupees were infinite. You could do almost anything you wanted with the rupees. There were always some tensions and difficulties about it, almost because it was too much money. And there was a feeling of proprietorship that Pennsylvania owned it or Chicago owned it or mm-hmm. what have you. Each time it was time for the president to retire, you were allowed 2 4-year terms. And then, as I recall, you couldn't have any more. But each time the president was doing so well that people say, well, let's keep him on. And then it would get more awkward. And then the feeling was, well, this person really had taken over. And the resentment built up about Norman Brown, and the same resentment was building up about Endemic. At one point, I was pulled in sort of as an outsider to look at this structural problem. Why was there always a crisis when the end of the second term arrived, and
uh-huh.
then there was always this, well, he's so good, let's keep him, and then once he kept them, people... So two of us who had almost nothing to do with came up with a recommendation, which wasn't all that clever, but which did resolve the problem, which was that the third year of the second term, there had to be an election for the replacement president, so that there would be a training, president uh-huh. in training the fourth year. Well, usually what happened would be there'd be nobody at the end, and then the thought of, we can't just start with nothing. So this was then written into the Constitution. I didn't realize that it would save my life later on because then they had to have an election because Ed Dimmick's term had ended. And there was a person who worked very closely with the Institute who was kind of an insider. And then I was brought in as an outsider.
Uh-huh.
It had almost nothing to do with people knew I'd worked with the college year program. And I was asked, was I prepared to add the presidency of the AI as to all the other stuff that I was doing. And I thought long and hard, and I said, well, the staff there is very good. We had the whole Indian staff there, and director general and offices and so on. And my impression is that they probably could pretty much run things. So sure, I'll run. And then to a certain extent, to my surprise, I won the election. And I was seen as an outsider. there was a feeling that the old boys were too clubby, that, you know, the friends were giving stuff to friends and so on, which I don't think was true. But anyway, resentment had built up over the years about the administration. So there I was, the president-elect.
And the year?
The year would have been, you know, become president. The president-elect in 85, to become the president in 86.
Okay.
It was an interesting year because at that point then I went with Ed Dimmick to India to be the trainee and to meet the government of India officials and so on, and to meet the director general, Pradeep Mandyanatha, who had risen from almost literally office boy to managing director. Very bright, very capable, very interesting, very complicated kind of person. And just about the time I became president, the public law for any money ended. It had been coming through the Smithsonian Institution. All the alarm bells were out there that the money will dry up, that at some point the government of India is going to forgive, the government of U.S. is going to forgive India the debt.
Mm-hmm.
And face it, friends, the money will dry up. This institution, which has been funding senior scholars and PhD candidates, will just go dry. Luckily, Ed Dimmick and the Smithsonian had set up a reserve fund so that each year when a grant was given to the AIIS from about 1981 on, about half of that was put into a separate account so that when the money ran out, there'd be 4 or 5 years of funding waiting for them. But it would just allow the thing to sort of die a dignified death.
Uh-huh.
And when I became president, I remember talking with the person in the Smithsonian who was handling the money, and she said, Joe, your job is to end the existence of the AIIS with as much dignity as possible, because there's no way in the world we're going to get the millions of dollars that it takes to keep this thing going. Just to keep the staff going in India is $1 million, and then where's the money going to come from for fellowships? So this was a great assignment to be the president of a dying institution for which the money was about to evaporate. And I had no brilliant solution to this thing at all. And all the old timers, I had not been with the program that long. I knew about the forward fund, this money that was saved away. And then we met a guy in the Smithsonian, Charles Lysenbacum, who said, if there's any way in which the money that's sitting in the forward fund could be made into an endowment, you could live off of that.
Oh.
But Congress never gives endowments. The money is always on a one-year basis.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Blitzer, B-L-I-T-Z-E-R. And he just was a guy who knew about the program. He was running the Woodrow Wilson Institute in Washington.
Had you known him?
Very casually.
Uh-huh.
And we dealt with the Smithsonian. He was a very pleasant person. He knew some India scholars. He knew my predecessors in the AIIS rather than he knew me, because I was a new kid on the block. Well, Charles Blitzer, may he live forever. Well, he died, but he figured a way of writing into one of the Smithsonian proposals a clause that was about 2 sentences long to convert the forward fund into an endowment. This is so undemocratic, but it's, I guess, the way these things work. And it was slipped in under some kind of appropriations toward the end of the season, and it was passed by Congress without Congress having a clue that they'd taken about $5 million that was sitting there in the forward fund to allow us to expire with dignity and create a rupee endowment, which would, if we harbored it right, be able to keep the thing going.
Uh-huh.
So we could hardly believe our good luck that this thing had passed, and it was politics of the worst. It was never debated. Nobody looked at it. They would have killed it if they'd have seen it happening. But it was what saved the Institute, and it was a combination of the wisdom of Ed Dimmick in setting the money aside, assuming that this would just be a dignified death.
Uh-huh.
Charles Blitzer knowing the way to put something into the tail end of an appropriations bill that wouldn't be seen by anybody because there were hundreds of extra pages, and getting it in. And then once it was in, we were terrified somebody would spot it and we'd be in trouble. But we nursed it, kept it quiet, and then gradually transferred it into our endowment, which was going to be held by the American Embassy in India, invested essentially in Indian returns, which were very good there. It was 15-16% on investments there. So sort of chunk by chunk, we took this $5 million and transferred it sort of bit into this endowment, which the U.S. Embassy is holding. And that got us through the crisis and said we could go on in the future with a limited extent. We don't have the limitless rupees. The next thing that happened was that Charles Butcher died. He'd been a terrible smoker, and cancer got him in the end. And then we learned that his estate, he willed essentially to the AIIS. Now, he was a bachelor, he had no other family, and we had not expected anything like this, but I guess he was so intrigued by a group of scholars trying so hard to set up something which would allow scholars into the indefinite future to continue to go out, junior scholars and senior scholars, to study, that he just felt this was a good way of doing. He had a big house in Washington and he had some other kinds of stuff. So he gave us another $1.2 or $1.3 million in dollars. So now we have rupees in the embassy, wow, dollars from the endowment, and what was to have been a dignified death sort of became, you know, a phoenix rising from the ashes. So there it was. Okay.
Again, I suppose we could use the word we've been using of fortuitous.
Yes. And
both of those items, the Congress's, the indifference, or actually, the request was so small, it probably was worthy of recognition.
Right, and tucked into some bill which they just sort of saw the title with. This was some appropriation of the Smithsonian, which they'd been giving appropriations to forever and ever. So anyway, the timing was right, the situation was right. And again, in my files, I have that letter from Charles Blitzer saying it passed. Anyway, when my 8 years were up as director of the, as president of the American Institute of Studies, I could feel good about it. Not,
I bet.
Yeah. It had been incredibly volatile, the roller coasters. I mentioned Pradeep Mandidatta. I have a file of his resignation letters. He had a very sensitive ego, and I would watch my colleagues say something or other that he could pick up as denigrating. And he'd be on the phone saying, I quit. I've taken all I'm going to take from American scholars. And I go through this, Pradeep, you know, you are absolutely indispensable. I guess I never believed he really was going to quit, because he was getting a very good salary and he was doing an extraordinarily good job. He had to get visas for the American scholars, and American scholars would typically write topics that would be sufficiently sensitive so that if anybody in Parliament saw that an American scholar was allowed to deal with something dealing with untouchability or something dealing with Muslims, their neck would be on the block. So it was always a case of negotiating the title of a thesis and trying to keep things moving, and periodically some would be turned out. The turnout ratio was low, 9 out of 10 would be approved, but the 10th was always rancorous and the American scholar would be irritated. And anyway, so Pradeep was a genius at handling these kinds of things, but also a very, very short temper and also very sensitive skin. And I can recall these, you know, India's 12 hours away in terms of phone calls, maybe middle of the night calls, where he said, I quit, you know, I'm done. One more insult from Harold Gould, and then there's one too many. And it'd be some sort of slight thing, he might say, you know, Pradeep, I don't think you're trying as hard as you could, or something like that. Bang, there it was off the top. So we survived, and periodically I'd say, you've got to continue until the next thing. And pretty soon the next thing came, building a building in India. Okay, now we had no money to speak of, but Pradeep had a way of squirreling away money that was left over of various kinds of grants. And then he and I got the idea of, let's see if we can raise money in India for putting up a building so we don't pay rent to these other people. There were several occasions we went to Rotary clubs in different cities in India and made the pitch. We were never very successful. We put on a dance concert. By the time we made the dance, we made almost nothing. But the idea of an independent entity was there. And Pradeep managed to get some gifts from the government of India to put this thing up. We bought some land about 20 miles to the west of Delhi. Got some wonderful plans for a very creative building built out there, where the land was so cheap. We had our opening ceremony with a Brahmin priest and a fire, and we're sitting cross-legged on a blanket in a field that formerly had rice on it. Now, that whole area is built up with offices, and our AIIS staff buildings in the middle there. It houses a wonderful research library in art and archaeology. It's a research library in ethnomusicology. It's where the staff is, and so on. So that, again, gives you sort of a feeling of coming through a long, thin period with something at the end which is quite substantial. The next president who was elected had been the person I'd run against.
Oh.
And he and I had worked very closely together. He'd been the treasurer. And this is Rick Asher from the University of Minnesota. And so Rick really deserved to be the president. He put in his time on the cross and handled some very tough financial things. Ed Dimmick had had cancer. Pradeep Mindrata had a heart attack. There was a time when sort of nobody was running this thing, and Rick had just stepped in and done a wonderful job. So Rick was the president for the next 8 years while we were sort of going through the growing process. And then Rick has been succeeded by Ralph Nichols of the University of Chicago, an anthropologist. So each one has been a very thorough, careful, committed scholar that has managed to keep this thing going. So,
and you're still involved.
After you end up being president, you're chair of the board of trustees, and then you exit out. And so when the 8 years were up for the chair of the board of trustees, I'd seen lingering academics in the past who would try to get free trips and so on. So I said, look, it's been a great 8 years as president, a great years as chair. I'm now withdrawing. If I can ever be useful, call on me. What I didn't say was, I don't want to be hangers-on like these people I've seen in the past.
Uh-huh.
Who do you pay for the tickets, or don't they? And do they get a vote, or don't they? And so on. So it's kind of a clean, neat end. And I have been asked to run special missions, see how the language program was going, talk to one of the campuses to see what the problems were, and so on. So troubleshooter is fine, but I wanted it to be a clear break. I put in my time as president, I put in my time as chair of the board, and now you guys keep doing it, and if I can be of service, great. I also wrote a book. We decided that after 50 years of American scholarship in India, there should be something that the AIIS would produce. So this is partly my idea to celebrate 50 years of the AIIS. We ended up calling it U.S. Scholars. I'm sure it's here. Yeah, India's Worlds and U.S. Scholars, 1947 to 1997. My thought was that so many of us who worked in India were forced to rethink our basic conceptual categories as sociologists, as linguists, as anthropologists, as political scientists, as musicologists, that we should record that. It wasn't a case of Westerners coming in and insisting that India fits our categories, because our categories weren't very good. So I became editor-in-chief, and we approached, I think, about 20 different academics, 20 more than that, to say, would you write a 15 or 20 page chapter on how your studying India made you rethink the categories of your discipline?
Huh.
And this was extremely interesting.
I'll bet.
Sanskritist, studied Muslim scholars, and so on. Well, putting anything together with a bunch of co-authors is a mess, and sort of it landed on my shoulders. But the end result, I'm really quite proud of. It's the first portion of it is the history of the AI. It's written by Maureen Patterson, who was a bibliographer in the University of Chicago for years, and knew Norman Brown and Dimmick and so on.
Okay.
And had kept copious notes. She's a bibliographer of the first order, just has files and files. And I'm helping her finish her 800-page book on the history of the Institute. But this is kind of a 120-page summary of what the Institute was. And then each of these scholars, sort of beginning with anthropology and ending up with, I don't know, zoology or something. And you get some sense of how another part of the world just makes you rethink practically everything you've learned here, which is scary, because then you think, well, I am the product of a certain intellectual heritage, which is what I've been trained in and has a certain logic to it. But I have to remain open to other systems when I get there and see how they sort things out if I'm to make sense out of the world as they look like. And each one of these was fascinating to read.
Did you write an essay?
I wrote one on sociology.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the impact of studying India on sociology.
Did you talk about your dissertation?
A little bit. I think I mentioned something like I could hardly be more wrong in my premises. I also talked about one dimension of sociology which I think studying India has brought in the study of Gandhi and nonviolent activism has generated things called peace studies and conflict studies in United States campuses. There now is an encyclopedia of peace and conflict study. And you sort of begin with Gandhi and the notion of a strategy for using applied non-violent activism. And now there must be 25 or 30 programs in the United States that either are certificate programs or majors where people study the application of nonviolence for social change, race relations, women's rights, LGBT rights, and so on. So that was kind of an input, which I felt the study of Indian society has shaped intellectual disciplines here. For example, there's the Kroc Institute in Notre Dame, the Catholic place, the main purpose of which is to look at applied nonviolence to introduce social change and justice. And you sort of trace the column, Gandhi's influence on Martin Luther King, and the way in which that was applied to the civil rights movement. So that was kind of one of the kickers in the chapter that I wrote here in terms of how studying India has introduced something into the Western crowd. So that was kind of the swan song for my part. This was my intellectual contribution, I guess, to the AIIS.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was to run off hundreds of copies and give them to everybody who'd ever given a visa to anybody in the United States, or any faculty, any Indian campus. Every fellow has to be affiliated with an Indian campus someplace. And it's kind of a bother to have some department chair sign on that they'll be accountable for Joe Schmo, who's coming in with a six-month grant to study something. So anyway, this was to be the great thank you, India, for what you've done for us.
Joe, switching to your work as a citizen of the university, if you would talk about your involvement on various committees and in the Faculty Senate.
Okay. The first committee I was ever assigned to struck me so bizarre that it seemed almost a joke. There had been a crisis of minute proportions. There was a tempest in a teapot. Somebody who had a research project on the campus somewhere had ended up with some extra money, and so he'd have a sign that cost, I think, $1,500 advertising the initials of this project. Okay. And he bolted it on the outside of the building in which he worked. He apparently hadn't cleared that through whatever one clears putting signs up on buildings, and some Buildings and Grounds people had come and seen this unauthorized sign, unscrewed it, and took it someplace else. This faculty member came and saw the sign missing, reported to the campus police there had been a theft. Anyway, here was this mess. I think, still untenured, and for some completely unknown reason, I was to be the chair of a committee to deal with signs on the university campus. What am I doing? And this had been created through whatever the process was that creates campus committees, and I had the director of Buildings and Grounds, I had somebody from the art history department, and we were supposed to begin with this question: what do we do with this sign, and who is entitled to put it up, and then what should we do about signs on the campus anywhere? And in the process, whoever was organizing this thing had taken photographs of various streets on the campus with absurd signs, every 15 feet, no parking or something like that. So this issue began to lead to almost bi-weekly meetings to figure out what we do with all of this thing. Should there be a body where all signs are cleared? Or should it be the campus police who decide this kind of thing? What if somebody gives a real ugly piece of art? Who decides whether that gets displayed or not? Well, I felt this is both the best of campus governance and the worst of campus governance. I have no right making these kinds of decisions or recommendations to whatever body we're going to make it to. But I was certainly meeting interesting people, among whom was the campus gardener, if there's a person for that, who described how lovely the campus could be if you could just have a little more money to put flowers in various parts. So it was all dimensions of the campus. Well, we came up with some series of recommendations that if there were too many no parking signs, there should be some space between signs, and if you see a sign here, you shouldn't have a second sign there, you see all right. In the end, the most important thing we came up with was a recommendation that the campus map be redrawn so that the miniature structure of the buildings would be represented. Because the map of the campus we had then was just of the surface. And so there would be a building, which would be, say, half a block, but whether it was 10 stories high or one story high, it wasn't visible. And so we recommended that the campus map be redrawn so that if it were Van Hise, then there were 16 floors, it'd be look like that. And if it was something flat, like an auditorium, it should look like that. Lo and behold, map is drawn, and it's in virtually every publication since then. Well, I was campus governance, and it's sort of weirdest, and you know, we came out with whatever the resolution was. In terms of more serious things, I've never been on the faculty senate. I really don't enjoy campus politics. It's, you know, I'm glad people do all that kind of work. But I have served on various committees that usually had to do with the administration of various programs. The Land Tenure Center was something I was very interested in here, and the Development Studies PhD program, which is an interdepartmental thing, dealing with the training of people who want to work in Africa or Asia. So from almost the beginning, I became one of the faculty members who would either be on the executive committee or part of the group of faculty who administer this interdisciplinary committee. I was elected to two fairly important campus committees. One was the Social Studies Divisional Committee, where you sit and review.
This is side two of tape number five of the October 11th, 2005 interview with Professor Joe Elder.
The years I served on the Social Studies Division were 1972 to 1975. It's a three-year term. And I guess there you are ultimately responsible for the quality of the academy in the Social Studies Division, because the courses need to be rigorous, they need to be defensible, they mustn't be overlapping with each other, they have to be carefully programmed. And most of the stuff you get is pretty good. But every once in a while something comes and you look at it and say, this just needs to be thought about a little bit more. You also deal with the tenure issues. Technically, it's the Dean of Letters and Science who blesses the tenure process. But the dean, I hadn't realized this while I was on the committee, essentially says, you go over these things. Now, these are being recommended by the departments to get tenure or not to get tenure. I want you to give them an independent review and give me your opinion. So, in a sense, you start from scratch. And these are, the one thing you have in common is you're all in the social studies division. So you're dealing with people in anthropology, economics, political science, social work. We also ended up with people in kinesiology or something. There were a couple of areas that didn't quite seem to fit.
Did you have history too?
History was in there, that's right, yeah. They make a distinction. Some of them see history as humanities and some see it as social studies.
I've never been sure.
They make the break. I think different people would, if you're sort of doing intellectual history or one, and if you're doing sort of economics and politics is something else. I think that's how they sort it out. But it was a lot of work, but you felt very, very, at least I felt very much the burden of establishing standards and saying, hurt though it may, if people aren't capable of keeping up the standards, they shouldn't be on the campus. And so we reviewed them from scratch a lot. You'd read the stuff that people have written. You'd also quickly realize how there were broad areas you didn't know very much about, and you had to be a little humble about deciding whether your judgment was ultimately something you could rest on. But you'd look at who was publishing, how much they were publishing, the length of what they had written, what their colleagues had said about them, and sort of with this mirror image plus your own independent opinion, you'd come up with ultimately a recommendation. This person seems to us to deserve tenure or not to.
Joe, would the divisional committee get, if, for instance, the sociology department denied somebody tenure, mm-hmm. Did the denial go to the divisional committee as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you would be entitled to review whether you felt the denial was justified. So the whole process sort of came through. So it was reviewing the courses in the social studies division and reviewing the candidates. And occasionally, you know, we make these hard calls. The first person I came in on the tail end of was a political scientist. They'd already made the decision. It appeared to be touch and go. He'd only published, I think, 8 articles, and the political science department felt there should be a book and several stuff like this. But the divisional committee had read the articles and said, these are really, really bright. And the quality is good enough, so the fact that the numbers aren't very high shouldn't prevent it. That was Booth Fowler.
Oh, wow.
Just made it to tenure, yeah. And Booth went on to be, you know, chair of this and that and so on, and one of the campus's distinguished scholars. But the fact that it was kind of the divisional committee that, that stood by and said, mm-hmm. this is really good. We had a couple of appeals where the case looked pretty feathery. At least once the candidate came in to present an appeal, you try to be fair and give every opportunity to the, whoever was being considered to look at what they had done. But ultimately, there was the sense that we have to have quality, and the whole institution depends upon having some kind of a line below which things might fall. So that was very interesting, with a lot of work, very collegial. And you did learn how different people evaluated. Did there have to be numbers? Did there have to be long publications? Did there have to be short publications? What if their teaching was or wasn't very good? You know, how did you balance all of these things out?
Do you think, on balance, the administration of tenure at the university has been equitable?
I think so, yeah. At both the departmental level and at the divisional committee level. Uh-huh. I know there's always a suspicion that, well, I can make some exceptions. There was one colleague in sociology who published almost nothing, but he dealt with statistics, which were so elaborate that I couldn't understand it. And my colleagues said, this guy is a genius. I mean, this one article he wrote is like Einstein. And all I can say is I can't make any sense out of it. Now, he was promoted, and he's produced virtually nothing since then. And that seemed to be one of those cases where I should have trusted my judgment. Uh-huh. This person isn't producing anything. And although he's a nice person, we don't have room on the campus for somebody like that. I have actually voted in two instances against the person I would say was my closest friend in the department who didn't get tenure. And I voted for him not to get tenure. Because nice though he was, and his level of performance wasn't what I felt a UW faculty member should be. Uh-huh. Which has meant that I have missed good colleagueship. I've had either of them remain. One was in the Indian Studies department, one was in sociology. We had a lot in common, but in each instance, in one instance, there was no way on earth I could have voted for him. He was a terrible, terrible teacher.
Oh.
Which is quite acceptable. He published a lot, but the students would walk out of his classes, they would feel completely bored and put off.
Uh-huh.
And with that kind of stuff, you can't have a non-teacher for it. The other was a very nice person in sociology, an African specialist, who was very engaging, very thoughtful, very bright, and just never seemed to be able to publish anything. And that was a little tougher, because I could see him fitting in as a guide to graduate students, uh-huh. and so on, and a very kind of quality mind. But if he hadn't published anything, there wasn't any likelihood that he would publish something. And how do you account for that? Is there enough administrative skills so that you could say that you ought to get? So those are two cases where I personally felt that there were standards that I just superimposed over the fact that they were literally my closest friends in each department, and sort of about the same age category.
How did you get on the divisional committee?
You had to be elected.
By?
All the social science faculty.
I see.
You vote, there's a humanities, social science, physical science, biological science, and so each of them has their divisional committee. And so you have to be either lucky or well-known, or just the count comes out somewhere. So that was one on which I was elected and served. And the other that I served on twice is called the Academic Planning Committee. And this, the deans keep calling this their kitchen cabinet. You meet once a week, every Wednesday afternoon, from essentially 4 o'clock to the rest of the day. And the dean of LNS lays before you all the things he's interested in. There rarely do you take votes, but you talk about whatever the issues are, and it's all kinds of stuff. And I was, and that's also elected. So I was on that committee from 82 to 84, and then again 92 to 95.
So you would have. So that's a dean's committee.
That's right.
And so you would have been working first for Dean Cronin and then Dean Certain.
Is it Dean Certain the second time? Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a transition in the middle. Dean Certain came in about then, right. So there you do end up with, I think it's very useful for the dean to have a set of people where he can sort of say, here are things that we're working on. at that point, it wasn't so much the intellectual rigor of the campus, which I fully enjoy, but it was all the bureaucratic stuff that goes with you know, decisions and administration and so on, which was useful. Somebody has to do it. But often it was, the choices were difficult and the money wasn't enough to go around, and it was the kind of thing, which of these worthy programs you turn down because there was enough money to go through. In each of these instances, I met wonderful faculty colleagues. And if there's ever a plus to these things, you're in with very, very amazing people who generally have a broad enough reputation so they've been elected by their colleagues.
Okay.
And so you're meeting physicists, or you're meeting people in French literature, or you're meeting people who are in astronomy, or people who are in, you know, bioethics or something like that. And you very quickly become kind of a family, because you're each struggling with these sort of complex issues. So they were useful. I think maybe once in a while we may have even been helpful for the dean, I'm not sure. But a lot of work, and every time I was relieved to get off it, because once again, to have Wednesday afternoons for other things was the sort of feeling I used to have when I was out for sports in college. I played soccer every fall. And so every afternoon from 3:30 till supper time was out. And then soccer season would end, and suddenly felt, all this time, look, I can do whatever I want from 3:30 to 6. The same sort of thing. It would rapidly get absorbed by all the other stuff, but there was that brief moment when you felt the huge sort of thing lifted off. And while you were there, you were also meeting the people who made the critical decisions. And deans have a tough job. I've never wanted to be dean. And
you've never aspired to
never,
be a dean.
And several times they've invited me to apply, and I've just said, no, this is not something that I would either do well or would enjoy. So I'd much rather be on an advisory group and do the kind of stuff that I do than sit there with these difficult decisions. Here are three excellent programs, and I can fund only one of them. Which ones am I going to say no to? And that's, I don't like that. Somebody else has to do it.
Yeah. Joe, if you would comment on on university administration, particularly the various L&S deans that you've worked with, challenges that they've had, and communications that you and the dean have had.
It's been pretty much episodic. Many times I was barely aware who the dean was.
Oh.
In fact, one of the things I enjoy about the UW is I often have to pause to think who's the president and who's the chancellor, because the place seems to run pretty well, and the critical decisions are made by myself and my colleagues. And I don't think that's true in all campuses. But anyway, the dean who was involved with hiring me was Dean Ingram, the mathematician. I never knew him well. I always had great admiration for him, and there's kind of a supreme irony that Ingram Hall was named after him. And by then it's like, here is Abraham Lincoln or something, an historic figure. Well, I remember sitting there as a candidate to be a faculty member talking to Dean Ingram, who was, you know, bright enough to ask questions about India, even though this was not his area especially. I knew Dave Cronin relatively well. Dave and I actually have been roommates in Oberlin.
Really?
He had come back as a veteran. He'd been a lieutenant or captain of the military police. So he was a whole jump ahead of me in terms of age. He was a counselor in the freshman dormitory. So we were in a triple. And as the senior who was the counselor, he roomed with two freshmen, myself and another freshman from Iran named Kumar Mushidi. So we had this unusual kind of start, and the difference between a freshman and a veteran senior are night and day.
Yes.
He also had a board job. He was a waiter, so he'd get up before the rest of us got up, and then he became very involved in campus activities. We had a mock political convention, and he was very much involved in that. So I sort of admired him from a distance as a guy who was infinitely older. And, you know, we got on basically well, but didn't see each other very much. His mother was a Quaker, and this was still when I didn't know very much about Quaker. And at one point we had met and chatted. Later years we didn't meet, talk about things. So I was aware that he went to Yale. He did his dissertation on Marcus Garvey. He'd been interested in Marcus Garvey because of a race relations course he took with George Simpson, who was one of the faculty members that interested me. And Marcus Garvey had this Back to Africa movement.
Right.
Eventually, his dissertation became a book, which I bought, and so, you know, kept it up. Then I was aware that he came to Wisconsin. He'd I know he won some teaching awards when he was in Yale at somewhere or other. I read some accounts of how he was trying to record. He was teaching World War II, I think, and he taped things from radio messages, Roosevelt's fireside chats, and the announcement that the war was over and stuff like this. So he came with a lot of stuff I admired. When he was dean, the relationship was a little more distant. We were still friends, but he was up there and I was down here. Our philosophies collided to some extent. He tended to be fairly conservative, and I tended to be fairly radical. I'm trying to remember any particular instances. When, on the planning committee, his tendencies seemed to be mostly to think of reasons why things shouldn't be done. I guess that was what I kept feeling. And that rather than exploring new ventures, it was one of sort of shoring up and saying, well, if we haven't done it, probably we shouldn't do it. So on several points, I felt it was a little bit frustrating to deal with a dean who didn't seem to be sparked by things I was sparked by. The area that I was most interested in was international relations and study abroad. And he didn't have any particular interest in this. I can recall at least one time where I'd written a suggestion that that it would not be hard to expand the study abroad programs. We had people around and so on. And the answer was there's just no money for it. And I had come up with various alternatives of how things should become. So I guess my feeling was that this is a dean who says no. Now maybe they just said no to the stuff that I was particularly interested in. He was around when the Vietnam War began. And on that, he was basically supporting the war, and I was very publicly opposed to the war. So that was another place where we just collided with each other. His wife was wonderful, and we periodically visited and stuff, but it was always a little cold. At one point, he docked me some salary. I was teaching in the summer, and the rule was that in summer you just couldn't miss a class because everything was condensed. And I was involved, I was asked to go to Sri Lanka and be a message carrier between the Tigers and the government. Something had come up. So I taught a seminar once a week, and I got one of my brightest graduate students to cover my seminar, which he could do perfectly capable. In fact, I felt in this area he was better than I. He was doing economic development. Made the mistake of reporting to the dean that I was going to be off campus for 12 days, carrying these messages back and forth. Returned to discover that this was against the rules, and the fact that I prepared the graduate student to cover didn't qualify because this was a graduate course and the graduate student knew it. So I was going to be penalized for not having shown up for work, essentially.
Now, even though you had notified them.
That's right. In fact, the mistake was I had notified. If I hadn't notified, nothing would have happened. But since there was a rule there saying that this shouldn't be done, and I could appreciate his position, which was if you do have a rule, even if it's a friend of yours, you make the point. I could not appreciate it because I covered it for myself and I felt fully responsible for the person I was training. The department felt slightly aggrieved at the fact that I was being targeted. They felt that what I was doing was thoroughly justified. Hal Winsborough was the chair of the department, and he at one point sort of went with me to the dean and expressed disappointment that a colleague had been docked. It was a whole, it was $800 or something like that. But that was one of those, it happens. Yes. And I urge the department not to make an issue out of it. If it serves the dean's purpose so that if somebody else comes up later and says, I want to take off, you say, we take money away from you if you take off, so I can appreciate that. That was a little bit of a rough spot in our relationships with each other. With the Phil Certain, there was never a problem there. Phil seemed to be much more open to a whole lot of things. Since we were at that point getting into the study abroad expansion, he seemed quite comfortable with that. The Global Studies Certificate Program, which I was involved in, sort of breezed right through. Later on, the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender Certificate Program that I was involved in sort of went right through. So in this case, I felt if there's a good idea and there seems to be faculty interest in it and has some intellectual merit, you're not going to hit a wall up there that says, well, we haven't done it, so we're not going to do it. So to the extent, these were the two deans I dealt with mostly. One seemed to be more on the side of saying no and no change, and one was much more willing to be open to other kinds of things.
Joe, let me ask you a comparable question about chancellors you've served under. Harrington, Shalala, Shane, Ward, if you've had much to do with any of them.
The only one that I sort of had personal contact with was Don Shalala.
Oh.
And the others I sort of knew about, but again, the fact that whoever is there doesn't seem to impact my life is something I like about the campus. Donna Shalala was a little bit different for a series of reasons. She'd been in the Peace Corps in Iran.
And really? I didn't know that.
Right. And she herself, I think, is from Lebanon. Not sure. I think Shalala is a Lebanese name of some kind.
Oh.
And somewhere along the line, we discovered this contact. And she was very, very open and talking with people. Early on, she said that she wanted to meet people off campus and do things. And so my wife and I picked up on the suggestion that why don't we just have a supper together, no big deal, and we'll talk about Iran and the Peace Corps. And at that point, Donna Shalala was very interested in international studies and things that were going in that area. So we had this incredible supper where she came over, and it was going to be at 6 and it was 7:30, and we were going to talk about Iran. Well, to add to the party, we invited my brother-in-law, who is a Badger football fan who exceeds all other Badger football fans.
I see.
So, and Donna at that time was trying to figure out what to do with the football team and the coach. So we got off on the two things which we were ostensibly going to talk about, Iran and the academic staff organization, which my wife had helped organize. This is the academic staff who have a voice and a body and elected and so on. Well, that took maybe 12 minutes. And then she was off on football, and here was my brother-in-law, Jim Lund. And he was going back over strategies and quarterback and coaches and this and that and the other, and they were at it for the rest of that supper on what seemed to work. And Donna had figured, I think, that it was important to have a good football team if there was to be support for the campus, and the support could be funneled into all kinds of things. So a strategy which I thought was bizarre, you know, why put money into the football team? We have a crummy team, and we need library, all the other things that academics say are needed, and here she is trying to get firing coaches and all sorts of stuff like this. But I could watch her mind working that if we are going to have a football team, and if we are going to get support from all over, it's important to have a winning team. So how do you get a coach that does that? And sure enough, she went, you know, marched straight on through and got a good football team out of it. The other arena in which we ended up working was a bit bizarre. At some point, I'm probably going to talk about how I got into the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender studies. It reached a point where there was going to be an all-faculty vote on whether the ROTC units, the Reserve Officer Training Corps units, were to stay on campus, because they discriminate against lesbians and gays, and the campus had declared that it was not going to discriminate against people on the grounds of sexual orientation. Madison had said it wasn't going to, Wisconsin had said it wasn't going to. So here we had, in a sense, a crisis of what I call hypocrisy,
mm-hmm.
with the Army, Navy, and Air Force ROTC units saying if you're lesbian and gay, you can't come in. So there was a faculty vote on whether the faculty would request the Board of Regents to terminate the contracts, because these ROTC units were in violation of the state, city, and campus statements. I had been involved in collecting the 200 or so faculty votes that we needed to have a vote on this particular issue. I was a group of maybe 8 or 10 faculty who felt this was sufficiently contradictory so that we should have a voice. And there was a provision in the way in which governance had established, so actually it was 200 faculty vote for an all faculty committee. There had to be one. This is, I think, the only meeting that was ever held. But it was in
the entire faculty.
We met in the cow barn. And it was a pretty hot issue. Donna did a number of things since I was sort of spokesperson. There were about 2 or 3 of us who were seen as the key people. At one point, she said, to the extent you need legal advice on how you put your proposal together, use the university lawyers, which was very nice, because when you're putting propositions up, you want to be sure the wording is correct. So we made an appointment with one of the university lawyers, and he helped us frame the resolution so that it was rigorous and that you couldn't have the various feet knocked out from under it because of the way it was framed. And I just appreciate her sort of getting in touch was with us. And because I could see some of the chancellor, this is a big trouble, and it's bringing a lot of negative attention, university faculty voting on what's happening and so on. So I had the feeling that she was kind of on our side, even though she was to be completely neutral. Before we had the debate, and I was to be the first spokesperson because I have more white hair than anybody else, she said, "We are on television, and a lot of people are going to watch the next 2 hours. I am going to be calling upon people at a certain point. We have person one, response one, person two, response two, but there are people out there who are going to have their hands up. And I want you to let me know which of them are likely to be responsible speakers and which ones aren't. Because whatever happens will be public. And you and I both know that there are people who can stand up and make fools of themselves or say very angry things or something." So I felt her whole approach there was basically, "I want this to be fair. And sort of, I want your side to be heard." Which I did appreciate, because we were, you know, kind of the minority in that particular instance. Well, the vote was held, and it came out that we won by a substantial majority. I have the figures here somewhere other. It was taking a minute to get it. So I'll read from the section that was written out. On February 1, 1988, the University of Wisconsin Faculty Senate adopted a resolution stating that discrimination in the UW-Madison Reserve Officer Training Corps programs, quote, violates fundamental notions of equal opportunity and privacy, as well as violating University of Wisconsin-Madison policy and the intent of state law, end quote. Now here's where I come in. On December 4th, 1989, at an especially called meeting, the UW faculty voted 386-248 to request the UW Board of Regents to terminate the university's contracts with the Army, Navy, and Air Force ROTC programs if those programs did not end discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation by May of 1993. That would let all the students who were in keep their scholarships until they expired. In its meetings in 1990, the Board of Regents voted not to implement the faculty request, but the Board of Regents did vote to instruct UW officials to work through elected political representatives of Washington to change the anti-homosexual policies practiced in the United States Armed Forces, of which the campus ROTC units were a subordinate part. So she played a key part, I think, first of all, in encouraging us to proceed, and then in a sense helping us get the groundwork so that we would look good. It was hard to tell whether she was happy the way the vote turned out or not. And one could interpret what she did next as a little bit of a pull the rug out under her. There were a lot of complaints that the faculty who were at the all-faculty meeting were missing people who were in chemistry and engineering because they had labs in the afternoon.
Oh.
So the old issue that the vote came out this way, but what did the faculty really intend? So there was an effort made to take a poll of the faculty, I think through some sort of phoning process or some other way, where people could send in ballots of some kind. And so there was a vote taken in which the majority flipped the other side, just a little bit. So you had two things. You had the official vote in a general faculty meeting, and then the kind of survey, which came out with the other side. And the survey may not have been necessary, except that had she said, well, the vote represents where the faculty are, the faculty felt disenfranchised because they went to the meeting would have felt this was not a realistic sort of thing. Now, we all knew the regents weren't going to accept this, but at least we felt our job was to make a statement, and if the regents chose not to do it, we had come out on the right side of this. So it was definitely mixed, but through that all, it was an interesting relationship which I had with her as kind of a representative of the faculty group that was concerned about the status of LGBT people on the campus. She subsequently set up a committee to work on the whole issue of making the campus friendly for LGBT people, and guess who was appointed to the committee? And sort of from then on, I've been on almost every major committee who's assigned the task of having the campus friendly to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students.
Joe, let me ask, and we do want to talk about that issue, but on Shalala, as you can surmise, there are a strong range of opinions among the faculty with whom I'm speaking. What's your assessment of her? Was she good for the campus? Did you respect her?
I respected and liked her and felt she made some mistakes, if that makes any sense. I enjoyed her enthusiasm. She was refreshingly accessible.
Was she?
I felt so. Now, whether the fact we both had Iran as our background and there was something unique there. But I felt she knew my name when we would meet. You know, she would say, "Hello, Joe." Unlike the other chancellors who, well, they can't know everybody, and obviously they didn't all know me, and we lived in a very different world. So I had a personal relationship with her, which a closer personal relationship with the others, and so that skews it to some extent.
Uh-huh.
She would make snap decisions. She made a couple of mistakes. There was one person that she picked out to be a dean of international studies who was not qualified. And he began to make appointments in the field that I knew of people that I could see were not going to work out. In this case, fortunately for the international studies program, some women began to bring charges against him about sexual harassment. And at first he denied that there was any problem there. So there was going to be a hearing, and apparently by the time there was a hearing, it was more than three or four. It was quite a number of women who brought charges against him that in his capacity as one of the intermediate deans somewhere, he'd harassed them. And so very quickly after his appointment, he resigned. I mean, he was fired for what he had done anyway.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of these things where I think a quick decision, if she waited a little bit longer, she would have spotted that this was a person who was in trouble. But heavens, is one who's made more mistakes just deciding how people are than I can acknowledge. You make one mistake.
Uh-huh.
I knew that she was controversial. I was puzzled by her football thing because that just seemed kind of a PR stance. But she worked very, very